You're listening to Spotlight on Heritage with John Costa and Rob Watson. How are you this week, Rob?
I'm very well, thank you, John.
Good, good. I'm looking forward to today. An old friend of ours that we're talking to on Spotlight on Heritage about jazz.
Okay. You're more into jazz than me.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm a jazz head, but I'm not as jazz head as our guest this week.
I'm here to be converted to the virtues of jazz. Yeah.
Well, I always think of Tina's daughter when we used to organise the Jazz at the Jar in the basement of the Cookie with dear old Tinny, and obviously my guest today. And she said to her daughter Demi about coming along to our jazz night, and she went, "Nah, jazz makes my ears bleed." Which is kind of, it's a great place to start with. An aficionado, Leicester's jazz aficionado, I'm going to call him, throw him right under the bus. Steve Beverley, how are you, Steve?
I'm all right, thanks. Blimey, well, that's a lot to live up to, John.
What, aficionado? I couldn't spell it, but I'll call you it. There we go. So listen, I'm really interested in talking to you about your sort of, you know, love of jazz and your inspiration. And, you know, from our very early days of knowing each other back in 2008, 2009, and Panch Panny Radio, and, you know, the jazz show coming out of the left field with our good friend Simon Parker. You're still doing your jazz show, and you're still into all your vinyl and doing jazz nights, which I'm going to pull out of you, all your sort of pop-up jazz nights.
But I was going to say it never stopped, but I suppose it did for a while. Because I was on Demon FM until they kicked out all the oldies and went off FM, so they didn't need us anymore. Fair play, but I had a good time.
And you're on Either FM now every Wednesday.
Yep, that's
right. Which people can listen to you. And obviously you put all your playlists out, and, you know, you work on it and you spend a lot of time on it. So these are all the things that we're going to pull out in today's recording. But my first thing is, what was your gateway music when you were younger? Was it always jazz, or is it something else?
No, not at all. So it would have been growing up pre-internet Radio 1, really. And if you think back to growing up in the 70s, so what was out at the time, but of course the 60s wasn't that far away, so you'd still hear
heavily
that
influence and stuff,
so you'd hear a bit of everything, a bit of psychedelia, a bit of Motown, and whatever was in the charts. And for a long time, I'm going to hold my hand up to this, I'm not ashamed, it was ABBA, first band I ever liked, still do, and I'd just find a new one, play it and play it and play it till the next one came out.
And you actually have a love of Eurovision, so I'm going to bring this in. I was going to end as well. So I was going to hit you with this at the end of the recording. Eurovision's a big thing for you. You're a regular fan and stuff. And do you think it comes from those heady days, I guess, of ABBA and it being a big thing on telly? I mean, I can remember watching it, you know, on television. It was the thing that you did.
Oh, yeah. And as a kid, I would have watched it without a hint of irony. I just loved it. It was a competition feel to it, the fact that I think we knew, this would be me and my sister, that some of the acts were a bit odd, and not everyone sang in English then, but it wasn't as sort of well-honed and sort of chiselled as it is now.
Polished. It's very polished, isn't it?
Yeah. Although you'll get the odd wild card, and that's why I still watch it. So it was a totally different animal way back then. But yeah,
have you still got that vinyl? So that ABBA album, do you still have that vinyl? Or are you one of these people that had vinyl, got rid of it, and then got back into it? I always think you've had this all the time, haven't you?
No. I mean, if you come to my house, you can still walk around it, just. I haven't got it in the bathroom or the bedroom, but I've got it in the spare bedroom. Oh, not in the kitchen either. But all the other rooms, not in the shed, though.
I remember coming to your house once, I think it was one Christmas, and I brought my parents, didn't I? And my dad was always impressed at the fact you had records going over the door, like on a shelf that went across the door. And he was just like, you can always tell someone who's really into it, because they've not just got it on shelves, they've got it on a shelf that goes over the door.
Yeah, I need to change them up a bit. I think it's probably the same records. Yeah.
They've not moved the look of them.
Yeah, they're probably a bit dusty now.
And when did you first get into jazz? When can you consciously remember? Do you remember your first jazz artist, or do you remember getting into jazz for a specific reason?
I've got a feeling it was sort of 82, 83. So I would have been buying a lot of records anyway in my first job, which was 82. And it was more pop artists that were jazz influenced. So it would be the likes of Sade, Style Council, Everything But The Girl, that sort of thing. And then from there, I think my dad had a Dave Brubeck album, so I remember buying a Best Of. And also, quite early on as well, Chet Baker, that I still love. I took a punt on one Chet Baker Sings, which is a really well-known one. And then sort of going into, I reckon, 85, 86, Giles Peterson, who's really well-known and about the same sort of age as me, he had a show on Radio London. So living in Kent, you could pick it up because, yeah, again, pre-internet, you know, so, but it would be on FM. And he had a show, I think it was called Mad on Jazz, but he did compilations as well. It still does, but these were called Jazz Juice, and I've got most of those. And though, so that was dipping my toe in a bit further. And it kind of went from there, yeah.
So, Steve, you mentioned about coming from Kent. Okay, so did jazz and a lot of this jazz performances and these people, when you're listening to people like Giles Peterson and stuff with your show, did it seem a long way away because it was always in London? And I remember having this conversation with my dad, you know, from the East End, and it was like, you know, he'd go up to the early Ronnie Scott's, but you had to go there. But I mean, at least he could, you know, jump on a bus and go. I mean, for a boy, young man from Kent, I mean, London was, you know, a train ride away, still a long way away from then.
Well, the funny thing was that you got, at the same time, I still liked a lot of pop and rock acts. So me and my mates, so when I was about 18, 19, going into 20s, would think nothing of jumping on the train. And you could get a train back the same night, because if you either got the 11 o'clock or well, there was the 1 o'clock milk train.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah, that dates me.
Yeah.
And so it's like, well, do we wait for the encore? Is there going to be encore? Or should we just go now? It's like, well, if someone like Prince, you've got to stay for the encore. So, and of course, you've got the energy to go to work on 4 hours sleep or whatever. But didn't really think to go and see any jazz acts. The only one I remember seeing was in Canterbury, so that wasn't far to go, and was Courtney Pine. And I remember being distinctly unimpressed, which is a bit of a weird thing to say, because he's a great musician. I don't know. I just don't think I was ready for it. I don't know. It's an odd one.
And that's an interesting thing about jazz, isn't it? I mean, going back to, you know, Demi's Jazz Makes My Ears Bleed, back to, you know, you not liking Courtney Pine when you first heard him. I think jazz is an acquired taste. And then you hear a lot of modern artists or artists over the years turn around that they're jazz influenced.
Yeah.
Stuff. What would you say when someone says they're jazz influenced, what does that mean?
There's little touches, you know. I don't just mean a pop of a saxophone or a trumpet. I suddenly went a bit of viz then. Sorry. So it's a strange one, because I kind of think in the other way around, where so someone like Ezra Collective, who I love, that I've just got quite a few awards lately, but there's no such thing as an overnight success. They've been doing it for a while. But they're influenced, and they are a jazz act, but they're influenced by stuff like grime and hip-hop and African music and a bit of everything. There's a kind of blend, and there's a few other acts around that, mostly from London, like Nubia Garcia, Coco Roco, that sort of stuff. And a lot of them just in that tradition of where they play on each other's records, which always happened in the past. You know, you think of a label like Blue Note in the States, you know, you start finding yourself looking at the sleeve notes and going, oh yeah, Herbie Hancock's on that one, Grant Green's on that one, but they're not, it's not their album, you know, they're a side man in that one. It's just the same now. This is how people make money, isn't it? You don't just keep on doing your own thing.
Mm. Now, if a young person was to come to you now and say, look, I've grown up, I'm thinking of young Tom here, Rob, who we spoke to the other week about his parents and stuff, you know, like the influence of the music, him growing up. Would you say to them that, you know, they've got all this vinyl, I've grown up listening to this, but you need to go and listen to jazz live? Do you think it's important that people listen to jazz live or in a live setting, or go somewhere like the jazz nights that you do where you play jazz vinyl in amongst other stuff in order for people to truly appreciate it around other people rather than just listening to it themselves?
I think that's a big part of it. So I'm really thankful when, because there's I mean, the main one in Leicester, and they've been going for a while, and their volunteers is Leicester Jazz House. They're always going to have their favourites, which aren't always mine, but every so often they'll put on a bit of a wild card for them, and I'll be all over it, like, where can I get my ticket, you know, because they're not that expensive compared to, say, London prices, and I haven't got to get a train or a hotel or a B&B overnight. It's there. But having said that, I don't go to every gig. You know, it's the ones that interest me. But yeah, there is something about it. Yeah, you can't beat it, really.
And when you think back to, say, some of the jazz nights that we ran over those 2 years and bootleg jazz, the festival and stuff like that, dipping back into the day. Do you think those things were, you know, a good thing to do? You know, is that missing now? Is it different? Do you think there's the audience for those kind of things still?
This is when we come back to Leicester being a bit of an odd place to put on anything. You might experience this in other ways. Even if something is free, and you'll get a lot of bands that would do that, they'll still get paid, and some aren't fussed, but they're happy to get noticed. But just to sort of galvanise people, get people
behind it, you know.
It's really difficult in all kinds of music, which is why you'll see, I think, a lot of people happily go to Nottingham, wouldn't even think of going to a gig in Leicester, but there are a few places left, but it's just a big ask. So there's a lot of people that would just do it off their own bat and say, well, okay, I'll take the hit if this does, or share it collectively if this doesn't pull in enough people.
So you're listening to Spotlight on Heritage with John Costa and Rob Watson. I'm going to bring Rob in here because he kind of threw his hat in the ring at the beginning, saying about jazz is not necessarily something that would be your go-to music, Rob. Is that a polite way of describing it?
It's wilder edges. I mean, there's a bit of jazz I like, you know, the Dave Brubeck and things like that. You know, it's kind of easy listening jazz, I suppose, but background music, you know, kind of Muzak almost. But the kind of wider extremes of improv and stuff doesn't really get to me. I think what was interesting was this, what you're saying, Steve, is the kind of communal listening experience. And I think we have, because in one way the performance technology has changed, so music venues are much louder. And when I go to music, I can't go to music venues anymore, it's too loud for me. And a lot of them are kind of, if you go to a bar or a cafe or something for a listening event, it can just be too loud. You need to be able to have just a comfortable conversation in the background. And so that performance, acoustic performance, is perfect for that. But as soon as you introduce amplification, it becomes quite intrusive, and people generally, the events I've been to, just put it on, whack it up too loud, and you can't do anything other than suffer the volume level. So I think decoupling the the way it's delivered and what's being delivered actually is an intrinsic part of, and jazz really comes out of small basement clubs in a way, doesn't it? So, you know, it's history and tradition, which didn't have, you know, noise pounding, you know, massive speakers.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you, which is probably why the sort of semi-acoustic bit would work for you, as long as it's not whacked up. And sometimes if it's a small bar, does it need amplification at all if they're just in the corner? I think it's the bigger room, so something like De Montfort Hall, and I'm not talking jazz, but there's a tendency I find in a lot of stuff, maybe not just there, where the drums are always mic'd up too loud for me. I just notice it straight away, and it's like, you know, I'm not a sound engineer, so what is that all about? There must be a reason. You can still hear the singer, you can hear the bass, etc., etc., but that seems to be a thing, but not so much in jazz. I'm just so... I remember I really enjoyed the gig, and it had been postponed several times because of the pandemic and illness of, it was Michael Kiwanuka. So I suppose he's kind of jazz adjacent, but, you know, more of a foot in soul and even a little bit of folk. And it's like, oh, do we have to have those drums that so loud? So I do get you about that ampli and how it can be putting you off.
Do you have, what have you learnt about delivering then jazz through radio, and how, because a lot of worked with many club DJs. If you were talking about Demon FM, and I used to work on Demon FM, and it was like you'd get the DJs in, and it's almost you can't, you've got to deprogram them from thinking that they're in a nightclub and that they're appealing to a crowd of 30 drunk people. And you get, but radio DJing is, and delivering a sequence of music, a program of music. What have you learned about that over the years?
So to me, it's very much two different disciplines. So you've already, you know, you're not trying to make people dance, and I like a bit of chat in between. I will play a long tune, or I might even play two together because they kind of, they work together. And I might, yeah, have a few that kind of have a thematically linked, but then I like to do like a left turn or a sharp right that would be something totally different that doesn't go with that at all, because that's all right, because I'm having a chat in between. But if you're trying to get people up dancing, that's a completely different animal. But even then, you build, you start off quiet, loud, pigs and troughs. And you don't want to batter people either. But especially in a bar, which I do once a month, and I love with, it's not my gig, it's my friend Marlon's gig, with Manjit as well, Basement Presents, Jazz on Vinyl, get me plug in. But even then, we'll have more up-tempo stuff, but we won't do that the whole time because we're in a bar and we don't want to annoy the owner or the people in there. They've come because they like it, but yeah, we're not going to batter their ear holes. In the end, we want people to come to the bar and they want to spend a bit of money, hopefully, and so they'll put us on again.
Steve, the Montreux Jazz Festival, I watched a fascinating documentary on BBC iPlayer about, you know, Claude Nobs, the guy who kind of came up with it and stuff, and how this sleepy Swiss lakeside place was turned into this jazz mecca. But his thing was he recorded everything. You know what I mean? This amazing jazz archive, you know, like a Montreux Jazz Festival record now was how it kind of got into America. This vinyl turned up and these people were like, well, where is this Montreux? You know, where is it type thing? You know, there's quite different pronunciations of Montreux, you know. Did the Montreux Jazz Festival, when did that kind of come onto your radar? Was it when you were younger? Was it through vinyl? Was it through watching documentaries? Did it surprise you when it came out of nowhere?
No, it's just reading about it. I'm aware, but more for a couple of albums that I've got. And I know that they put on, they also put acts on that aren't jazz at all, which always is a bit of a head scratcher.
ZZ Top appeared in this documentary, which I thought was quite strange.
Mm. But, yeah. And I like lots of different music, but it's like, is this a jazz? I don't know. You don't want to be too prescriptive. So, yeah, it doesn't, although I know of it, it doesn't impact upon me. It's a bit like Ronnie Scott's. I know of it. I've never been.
It's never been like a place that you had to go or a mecca that you had
to go. I'd like to at some point, but it's more what we were talking about earlier. It's economic. You know, you've got to find somewhere to stay. It's not like when I used to live in Kent. And now I don't think you can get those lake trains anyway. But, you know, you've got to find somewhere to stay. I should imagine it's not cheap, etc., etc.
So how do you approach your playlist every week for your show? Do you, like I said, sometimes it's thematic, sometimes it's someone who's passed away, a sort of a jazz great, sometimes it's just what you're feeling or what you're listening to at your particular, at that particular moment.
It's all of those things, all of the above, but not at the same time, obviously. So if it's someone that's influenced me, so Sergio Mendes, I actually did two shows because one wasn't enough. Unashamed, all Sergio Mendes. Someone else, they get one show or even just 20 minutes, depends. I'm not going to try and do everyone that's passed on because some people I might not be so keen on. But otherwise, it's just what I'm listening to lately, or I'll try and dig something out from my collection that I haven't heard for a while. But I will stick it on my phone and just listen to it when I'm walking around, when I'm on the bus. And of course, you can favourite something and I'll stick it in a work in progress list. There's always an ongoing list which I can pick a few from, but then hearing one tune will spark off another one. Have I got that? Where is it? That sort of thing. And although it's a 2-hour show, the music is only about an hour and a half, allowing for ad breaks and me jabbering on in between. So it's not quite as onerous a task as you'd think it is. And probably normally on a Sunday is when I put it all together and do the social media bit, and then it's done until I do it on the day, and then I don't have to think about it. But it's always ongoing, me listening to stuff. And sometimes I need a break from jazz, so I do like other music. So I remember a while ago, I want to hear an REM album. I don't want to hear any jazz. Just bang it on. Oh, yeah, that's still good.
Mm-hmm. And how do you approach your links between the songs? Are you there to give people an interesting fact or nugget that they wouldn't know about that particular person? Is it more about, oh, this made me feel like this? Maybe you're talking to the listener about that. That's what I like about when you listen to the Jazz Shambles. It's more about, it's like you're sitting with you and you're going through your record collection and kind of sharing those kind of experiences.
Yeah, I think that's exactly
it. Or do you not overthink it?
I don't know. Sometimes I might write something down, because I always write a playlist down in longhand, which is terribly old-fashioned, but so am I, in sort of roughly 20 to 22-minute chunks. If it's a bit longer, then I know I've got less time to speak because I want to cram it in. But yeah, this is a thing that I remember about Demon, is that the young people working there would talk about content. I went, that's just talking in between records, isn't it? You know what I mean? It's like,
don't use long words on me.
You know, I just thought, I'm not going to swear, but I would like to when I hear the word content. It feels very much like an influencer sort of word, you know. But that's, you know, like a 40-year age gap. So it's just how people talk when they're presenting shows. Whereas for me, I bang a tune on, I like it, I might say something about it if there's a memory or why I like it so much, or I might not say much at all and just go right on to the next one.
So my next question, Steve, is I've been listening myself on YouTube to jazz kisas, which are like cafes or listening bars, as we were talking in the lift there, in Japan and stuff. And it's interesting, Rob, you were talking about Japan and your partner being interested in Japan. Is this something that you've come across before? Is this what you're trying to influence when you're playing your vinyl, which is like people coming into a bar and listening to jazz? And it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because there's quite a famous person, I can't remember his name, but he was like, you had to sit in silence and listen to the vinyl. And then other people were like, well, no, you need to allow that kind of conversation. Where do you stand on that?
I would definitely be the conversation. Maybe not at a live gig, although guilty. But probably not if it's, you can hardly hear a pin drop. I'm not going to be that person. But no, if you're playing tunes and it's in a bar, let's not be too precious about it. It's not my art. It's someone else's art. And I'm playing one tune after another.
And you're just facilitating it.
Yeah. But the whole idea of the Japanese listening bars fascinates me. And there's four really good compilations, vinyl CD downloads, called J-Jazz. But it was a couple of British guys that went over there and discovered all this stuff. Because I had no idea that Japan was influenced by American jazz from way back when, to the point where they started sort of sounding the same as them and then going off in their own direction. So loads of artists that I'd not heard of. And so, yeah, of course I got all four, but I didn't buy them on record because they were quite expensive. And now, of course, the price is going up, but I'm happy with the CDs. So I'm aware of it. And yeah, the trouble is you can get into deeper waters and then it gets more expensive. But that's the whole thing.
I think jazz is definitely a gateway black hole when it comes to spending money for music, isn't it?
It's a disease. I've had one record fair and record store day recently. Yeah. Got to eat as well, though. You can't.
And how do you decide? I mean, okay, so you're there, and there's like a couple of things that you're like, oh, I need them on my shelves. What do you have a criteria that you think, that is, I'm never going to find it again, or I've been looking for a long time? You know, what's your criteria for adding to the jazz vinyl collection?
One, I've been looking for it for a while, and then it's just priced so that the person is not having a laugh at your expense. You know, if it's too much, I'm not going to buy it. But sometimes if it's right in front of me, because I live on my own, so there's nowhere you could deliver stuff. So I don't go down the eBay Discogs route, thankfully. Otherwise, they're in madness.
You'd be in real trouble. You wouldn't be eating.
I really wouldn't be able to eat. So sometimes when it's in front of you, you can have a look and go, well, okay, done, Bosch. Thank you very much.
It's interesting. You were saying there about is the person having a laugh with the prices they charge? Rob, I'll bring you in here as well, because we've had this conversation before about when you're into something and you're collecting, like, you know, like going to Hopkinson's, for example, in Nottingham, and you're thinking, oh, I'm adding to my, I mean, especially someone who's got museums like me, you know, postcards or maps or National Geographic, and suddenly the price goes through the roof because someone's decided to have a Pinterest about it and someone's influencing about it on TikTok. The price goes through the roof. That kind of having a hobby is quite hard, isn't it, when someone's trying to do this with the price?
Yeah, for me it's books. So it's books and music, but now I can, my music has been sorted by access online, so that's kind of stopped me from buying CDs, but I've still got boxes of CDs there. But it's books is the one that I kind of compulsive, and it's separating out that kind of, but I can't remember the name, I saw it, there's a Japanese phrase for just collecting things, like collecting books that you've actually got no intention of to read, and it's like a reassurance that you've got it. It is like it's an instinctual
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, I'm aware of that. Yeah,
yeah, you know, and yeah. It's something to have and gather those things. I suppose the problem is that we don't have the opportunities to use them properly, mm-hmm. and to be value those things. We've privatized a lot of this stuff, so our home experience. You know, there's that. Who was the artist who did In Every Dream Home? What's it called?
Heartache. Music.
That was based on the painting of the famous one of the pop art painting in the 1950s. I can't remember the guy's name, which is like the weightlifter. You've seen it all, and it was about the idea of turning the home into a place of entertainment, personalized, privatized entertainment. And so we collect these things, but we kind of collect them because it's not part of a public library, it's a private library. And I think having, you know, maybe what we need to invest in is kind of more shared collections, where you kind of pool your resources and it becomes something that you then do, you know. What are you going to do with your collection, Steve? Is it, you know, other people are going to sell it on, you know, is it going to go to landfill, or is it going to be donated to somebody?
I've already thought about it. So if Loris is still around, as and they have a dedicated record shop, that's where I get a lot, that's where it's going. My sister gets first pick if she's still around, and then I'm gone, have them.
How are you feeling? No.
Well, dodgy feet.
So, Steve, thanks for coming and talking to us today. It's great talking to you about on Spotlight on Heritage, particularly about jazz, and it's nice to kind of draw a bit of a line under it as well when it comes to jazz as something that's heritage, because it influences everything. So I'm going to be very personal now, and as someone who's come around your house and seen your vinyl collection and stuff, when you see programs about, like, you know, Barbara's a hoarder, you know what I mean? So all her stuff's gone into a warehouse, and someone's forcing her to throw away a skip load of stuff that she loves. All joking aside, do you consider yourself addicted to jazz? Do you see yourself as a hoarder? Do you see yourself as an over-enthusiastic collector? I mean, how do you view yourself? If you had to give yourself a LinkedIn profile when it came to jazz music, what would it be?
Probably most of those things, but really, you know, I try and dress it up and go, oh, connoisseur.
Connoisseur. Yeah. Well, I'll use aficionado, and you've just used connoisseur.
Because
so
it
good.
Sounds better than hoarder, and it conjures up. I go back to that old program. There was a character called Mr. Treebus, and his home, you had to sort of dive through holes to get from one room to the other because it was so full of newspapers and books and who knows what. I might add, you can still walk around my house.
Yeah. Okay. Now, a lot of people collect things, don't they? And of course, when you collect things, sometimes there's actually an end, as in, like, you know, there's only so many of these things, or so many were made, so many were printed, mm-hmm. so many were pressed. Whereas something like jazz, I think it's almost like a journey. It's almost like a lifelong journey. You're always learning, your tastes change, you're influenced by something else, something new comes along. Mm. That actually being involved in the jazz scene, in Leicester or been involved in that. How do you see, you know, when you're putting your records on, are you thinking all that might have influenced someone to go off and listen to that? Or do people come up to you and say, oh, I've never heard of that before, I'm going to go away and listen to that?
You know, I never think that. I just do it for myself because I think that's the best
way. I knew
way.
He ignored people, Rob. He just ignores people. When he's behind those decks, they're like a brick wall.
I always think of this, right? Eat it up, it's good for you.
Oh, right, yeah. So, yeah, it's like eat your greens, they're good for you. If you don't want to do that, at some point in your life, you'll come back and go, do you know, I needed jazz.
Yeah,
like
just
a tonic.
Didn't know it, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, how often do you go out and perform?
I wouldn't call it performing, but I'd call it standing behind some decks.
Performing.
Putting one record on after another.
Yeah. Do you miss it? Do you miss it when you don't do it?
Yeah, terribly.
Do you miss when you're not on the Jazz Shambles one Wednesday between 8 and 10 on either FM?
There aren't many that I miss, but I do, and that's normally through illness or if I've gone away for a day or just something. Actually, once it was a gig and it was in Leicester, but it was jazz, so I thought that was a good enough reason. But also the monthly one I go to, which is just once a month, Flames Records. Sometimes work gets in the way and I can't make it. Yeah, and I was thinking, what are they doing now? What are they playing? But also, what's nice about that is more of a bit of a social for me. So there'll be people I know or people I've got to know, and you get to chat about it as well. So it's not also so much chin stroking as you'd think it would be. We can be that way, obviously.
And do you find, and this is kind of, I'm going to talk to you here particularly about, you know, as someone at home, I've got all of my private collections of stuff and my archive and stuff, and sometimes I can lose hours down a rabbit hole of looking at things and pulling maps out and finding things that I'd forgotten about that I've got. I mean, do you lose time that way as well?
Oh, for sure. And sometimes I'll find something that I thought I'd lost, and that's a great moment. There it is. Whether it's a record or a CD that's just got misfiled or whatever. That happens a lot with compilations because I try and order them, but it's virtually impossible. And because I play out once a month, then records get put everywhere and don't get filed back. I'll probably do it on Bank Holiday Monday if it's raining. I'm sure it will be. And do it then. And then within a day or two, it would be a complete mess again.
Brilliant. Steve, thank you for taking the time to come and speak to us today.
It's been a pleasure, mate.
Long may your jazz playing continue.
Thank you so much.